Everybody, we have the claps so I can match up the audio, which I don't even really use them anymore. But welcome to What Are You Guys Talking About?
What are you guys talking about?
So today is the day of days, people. We are going to talk about Ex Machina.
It finally happened.
That's right. So
it's like it was foretold.
It was foretold for about 3 podcasts.
And
I feel kind of bad now, so we're going to open up with a bit of sadness. I found out today that my awesome short that was really good, but still didn't make the top 10 cut for the Arrow short video or this Arrow film thing. I kind of feel bad now that we pushed Ex Machina back so I could do 2 whole shows talking about my amazing, you know, COVID-19.
No, I get it,
and then the worst thing was the 10 that have made it are really good. Like, don't get me wrong. Really? I think ours is good, but the quality on the 10 that made it through is so high. And I'm like, okay, more things to learn.
I mean, you know, it's a journey.
Well,
it's a journey.
And I'll get into that as we're talking about Ex Machina, because I think Ex Machina is a film for the end of your independent journey. So when you get to that, this is the high point that you will achieve before you go on to your, you know, Marvel,
almost like the
Marvel Cinematic Universe.
The bridge, right?
That's right. Like, this is as good as it gets. But before we do that, let's just go back to, obviously, the places we like you to visit. Please always check out our website, www.lovevictoriaproductions.com. There is a ton of really cool stuff there. Now, albeit at the moment, it's a bit hard to find. So for new videos, new podcasts, you have to scroll to the bottom of those screens. And the extra pages at the moment don't have anything populated in them. As I said, it's been sat in limbo. My day job is very busy right now. So when I can sit down, or when I can get somebody else to sit down with me and do this, then we will get it done. But that is the best place to get a hold of us. There is a contact button. So if you have projects that you want someone to work on, we are actually getting really busy, but I want more. I always want more. And I can always field more teams. Despite the fact that our website can't get fixed, I can get you a production crew to do what you need to do. So please, 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 if there's something out there that you're just listening and you're like, I wonder if they do a music video for us, or I wonder if they would do, you know, a documentary for us. Like, we do just about anything as long as we like the concept and we work for cheap, guys. Not that we're cheap workers, but we are, you know, at the beginning of our career, so we're more than happy to kind of negotiate with you on...
Or a cheap date.
Exactly, on what you need for that particular project. And we're pretty good at it, too. We've been doing the cheap indie thing now for a couple years, and there are definitely some cost-cutting kind of ways we can get things done for you. Anyways, so that's the business end of things. But if you want to just talk to us or just, you know, reach out, you can check us out on Facebook. We've got a Love Victoria production page. We've got Ed's page and my page, Jason Chereau. Last name is a bit funny, Cherot. For those of you, somebody didn't know that this week. And I was like, yeah, it sounds very different from the way it is. It's French. So we also have Instagram. We've got Enano LVP and Jazzy J Chereau. I would say that's one of the best places to kind of see what we're up to, because we post a lot of either BTS or latest updates on our podcast. A lot of stuff goes there to show you what's actually in production at the moment. You can check us out on Twitter. So we've got @MouthLoveVictoria. That's me. And then you've got @Ananoskiprod. I'm quite active on Twitter, at least about tweeting about things. As I said, a lot of people don't kind of reply to my tweets or forward my tweets. I'm not even sure anyone actually looks at my Twitter account. But if you want to, I'm always there and I'm always posting something, because I am one of those people who likes people to know what I'm doing, kind of thing. So usually it has something to do with movies. Sometimes it has pictures of my dog. Other times it's just me ranting about something. But it's always something interesting. So by all means, check it out. Finally, we also have LinkedIn. We have a Love Victoria page. Ed has a page. I have a page. I would say this is probably our least popular venue at the moment. I have a few friends on LinkedIn. That's why they get all the postings, because they work with me on some of the film stuff, either on illegal stuff or other things like that. But in general, it's that page is for my other job. So it's one of those things that you're more than welcome to contact me there or contact Love Victoria Productions. But we're not frequently on that page doing Love Victoria things. So I would just put that as a reminder. But with that all said, that's all the different places you can find us. Please reach out. Please share. Please subscribe. You know, we're on Podbean, you know, Apple Podcast, Spotify, lots of different places, and we'd like to be in more. So please share us, put us out there. And if you enjoy the show, then let us know.
If you enjoy the show, let us know.
I know, I'm the Johnny Cochran of this podcast right now. The glove does not fit. You must acquit. God, I love that, man. I you know, Johnny Cochran's probably the reason I became a lawyer.
Did you watch the American Crime Story, the show that they did?
The Netflix on No, I never have. I should, because I watched it religiously when I was a kid. That's what it literally, you know, the O.J. Simpson and the Menendez brothers trials were right as I was growing up. And basically, funny enough, I never became a trial attorney in the end, but that's what pushed me to want to be a lawyer and why I, you know, decided to qualify as a lawyer. So
I could see that.
I just, you know, I like a good argument. But let's move on to Ex Machina.
Boy, do I know that.
Yeah, that's what makes me a good producer. Let's move on to Ex Machina, though, because I really, really do love this film. And I wasn't drinking the Kool-Aid as much at first. I was, you know, I watched this. Ed asked me to watch it. I watched the first, I would say, half hour of it. And I was like, I kind of remember this being better the first time I watched it. I just wasn't getting into it. I watched it again.
That is a really good point, and we are going to come back to that. But sorry, continue.
So I went back and watched it another time. And then, to be fair, while I was doing this, I was also Googling a ton about the production, because Ed made a big deal about this as a really good sci-fi made on the cheap. It is. It shows you both the good and the bad of sci-fi. So what I will say about this film as a first impression from a production standpoint, this is an indie film. However, it is the highest caliber indie film you're going to get. Okay, sci-fi, I just don't really see at the moment how it can be done on the mega cheap, because you need things to look futuristic. So there are a few choices on this that kept the VFX way, way, way down. And we're going to talk about that. But this is not going to be your first film, okay? Nor would it ever be anyone's first film. It's highly produced. It looks beautiful, and it's a great story. Now, we're going to talk about all of those things as we go through this, because I think that is what makes this your final film, not your first film. They nailed every aspect of this to the point where I don't think they had too many problems. Now, it's saying on Wikipedia it had a budget of $15 million. The actual budget that's listed is $10 million, not $15 million. And it grossed this is really funny. I must have been looking at a different page yesterday, because it grossed $38 million altogether. So I don't know, maybe that's IMDb versus Wikipedia, right? Mm-hmm. But point being, you know, asking for $10 million on a film, mate, you're stepping outside of indie there a little bit. You know what I mean?
Although the last two films that we did review, like, was it Hereditary and Midsommar, were in that range, right?
They were close, yes. So Hereditary was 10, and then Midsommar was 9. So yes, so it is a good point to bring up. I just, on this one, because I think the budget could have gone way over $10 million, this is not a film that I see you pitching as, I just got out of film school, or I've made a couple good shorts. And this is good. So maybe that's what I mean. And Ed's always really good at that, about, and my sister pointed this out, about kind of correcting what I'm saying, because it's true. Like, yes, there are other $10 million budget films that we said could be your first film. All I'm saying is this is not one of them, okay? And the cast behind this will show you that. So you've got Alex Garland, you know, the guy who did the Beach, now coming up for his directing stuff, also did 28 Days Later. You've got
he's famous for writing, right? Like that's his big thing. He wrote the book for The Beach. Did he write the script for The Beach?
I don't know. We should check that. We can, as I said, that's why I have the Wikipedia open. I will just
he definitely wrote like 28 Days Later. I was saying that he wrote the book The Beach when he was like 24 or something like that, which was a massive thing. And then when he went to the set of The Beach with Danny Boyle directing that, he actually turned around and said, okay, this is what I want to do. I don't want to write books anymore. And he started writing a lot for Danny Boyle. Like he did 28 Days Later. He did Sunshine, and then he wrote Dread. But there's like rumors that he actually directed Dread, and
that's what I had heard. Yeah, I mean the stuff I was reading from the producer's journal that I was telling you about, they said he directed Dread. Now Wikipedia is saying that he wrote Dread. Now,
right?
From what I understand, Dread was his first film. So I can't. And I would tend
The trouble is, it's a credits thing, right? And this is where you get into guilds and all this kind of stuff. So I think essentially the original director of Dread was fired, and Alex Garland took over at some point, and he felt like he deserved a directing credit. But I think that's when guilds and stuff start, because he'd never directed anything before. And he was credited as the writer. And I think a settlement came about where they said, oh, no, we're keeping it as it is. I didn't direct it.
but I think he just did.
Yeah. So the rumor that I'm reading, and I'm literally just reading it, Carl Urban. So that's who plays Dredd. And if you haven't seen Dredd, by the way, it's freaking amazing. Oh.
Fucking awesome. What a great first film.
You don't
if
understand
that would have
how
been
long,
his first
so,
film.
So to give you a bit of history of Judge Dredd and Jason, I had a really cool auntie. She's gone now. She died quite a while ago, but she was really cool. She lived over here when I was a kid. So she lived in Cambridge when I was a child. She used to always, she was the artsy auntie. So she always sent me, you know, the first time I ever saw Warhammer 40K, she sent me a bunch of Space Marines and said, have some fun painting these. And typical me, cool. Like, I didn't even bother painting them. I just opened the books and was like, these are so cool. And she was like, didn't you like the miniatures? I'm like, what miniatures? But she used to send me, and I still have, actually, you know, testament to her, I have them right behind me in this office that I do the podcast from. She sent me Judge Dredd comic books. And what I can tell you about comic books in England is they are inherently different. Not a whole lot different, but there's just an edge to them that you don't have in American comics. And so, obviously, my friends found out I had these, and I was, like, the coolest kid on the block. Partially because Dredd also has nudity in it. So, God knows, 11-year-old boys like, dude, boobs, boobs, look, there's lots of boobs. Boobs. That'll sell just about anything to an 11-year-old. Boobs, you know? But also, they were cool. And so, like, I was a big Judge Dredd fan. I actually ended up having, like, this entire collection. I had audiobooks. I had books. I had all sorts of crap. Like, I just loved Judge Dredd.
That's awesome.
And then, obviously, right around the same time, who becomes Judge Dredd? Sly Stallone. Now,
Sly Stallone. Yeah.
Okay, I still love that movie. Now, don't. Now,
you're all gonna get mad
at me for saying
spot.
That, but I
no,
absolutely
I have a soft spot
saw it in the
it.
Theater with my father. I still thought it was awesome. I could still watch it today and be like, it's still an awesome film. It's just not Judge Dredd. It's not
right.
It doesn't. It feels like a reprise of Demolition Man to me. Like that's basically what it is.
Yeah.
And that's cool because I loved Demolition Man. Who didn't?
Yeah, Demolition Man was awesome.
However. Then, like, it was when I moved to England, and I wasn't even following Judge Dredd anymore, not reading 2000 AD, you know, like, don't get me wrong, great comics, if you haven't read them, please go out there, pick up a copy, because they're awesome, like, they're really good. But I wasn't really into it. My neighbor, you know, fellow geek at the time, was like, hey, have you seen Dredd, the new movie? And I was like, no. So he hands me the DVD, and, like, I just remember watching it, and I immediately watched it again, because I was like, that was so good. It's short, too. It's only, like, 78 minutes, 80 minutes. So it's instead of, like, it's what was good about the Sly Stallone one. So luckily, no one ever really tries to do the Judge origin story. Now, they go wrong in the Sly Stallone one by trying to a bit, you know? And I'm like, no one cares where Judge Dredd really came from. That's not his story. His story is he's this like uber cop judge, whatever. This movie, that's all he is. Like, they don't tell you anything except he waltzes up to this building and shit's
There's
about
no
to go down.
Story.
And I'm telling
it's
you, every
like,
comic book that was ever written about Judge Dredd is the same way. Like, it's not, oh, this is where he comes from, or this is what you love about 2000 AD. They don't care. They're just like, here's a building. There's some, like, there's some blitzers that are going to do something bad to him. Yeah, Judge Dredd's going to do something cool.
But yeah, going back to Ex Machina, which is no, totally. I totally agree. And big shout out to Dredd because it's a great film. If you haven't seen it, you like sci-fi, it's a must watch in my opinion. So Alex Garland kind of directed that one, kind of didn't. And then this one comes along, which he also wrote. He writes and directs it. And it's his first official credit with the DGA.
Now, the funny thing, again, I'll bring up about this film, the other thing that took me completely by surprise, and it shouldn't have if I'd seen this nominated thing right in the Wikipedia page, but listen, this film is like 6 years old. It looks like it was made yesterday.
It's still fresh.
It's very fresh. You know, I had Ed look up the background because I had read a blip about the lenses that they use for this and that having a really good effect on the shots. It's crystal kind of clear. It's wide. But then the VFX, which I want to talk a bit about that, because the VFX aren't nearly as complicated as you would think. They took a lot of time and a lot of precision, but what's actually been done in the film is not nearly as complicated as you would think.
I mean, it's a very traditional way of doing things with film.
Yes. And that's what I loved about it. So that's where, as I said, you come on this podcast either to listen to the two of us rant, which we're going to do, so don't worry. You're going to get plenty,
it's gonna happen.
Plenty more
it's
gonna of happen. That. I have plenty of family members and friends who listen to this too. They just like to hear the two of us going back and forth. But if you are that indie filmmaker or someone who likes indie filmmaking and getting into this, let me put this in context. Like, this is not a film I'm saying that you should dissect for all its indiness, okay? It's a high-budget film. It has some high-concept stuff on it, but there are, I would say, probably two or three important elements for an indie filmmaker to see in this. One is story, okay?
Yeah.
This film lives and dies by its story, okay? That's the only reason these cats were able to get the money that they needed to get for it, because the story is dope. It works. Yeah. It's not simple. It has a bunch of twists and turns in it, but it's followable. It's more followable than the stuff we were doing with Ari Aster, where that's one of his problems is, you know, and I have this in my own writing that people just can't always follow what I'm doing.
Yeah.
You know, this, what I really liked about the writing is it seems confusing, but then wraps up those parts. So the most satisfying kind of writing, I think, for a viewer, and this is just my opinion, so you can scream back at me if you disagree, but the most satisfying is the type that ties up these loose ends, that says, no. Mm. Like, the only thing we really don't know, and here come the spoilers, so if you're not watched this yet, get off now.
We're past first impressions.
Go away. Go away and come back. So, the only part that goes unexplained that I think is good to be unexplained is the what happens to Donald Gleason's character.
Yes. That's something to talk about, for sure. Yes.
I mean, the ending...
Because...
Yeah, no, go ahead, Ed. You talk about it, buddy.
Sorry, I was going to say I remembered it being one way after watching it the first time, and it wasn't the way that I remembered it.
Ooh,
watching it the second time.
I agree, too. Did you watch it on Netflix?
No.
Okay, because I watched it on Netflix, and I thought I might have had a different version than the one even though I'm pretty sure I watched it on Netflix the first time, but the ending was different, like you said, than what I completely remember. There was one scene additional. We'll just talk about it real quick here. The scene where she's on the street, because one of the things she says to him that she wants to do is that she wants to be on a busy street to see what people are like. I only remember her leaving the compound. I don't remember the street scene. So were you the same way? Because like all of a sudden she's on this busy street, and I'm like, I don't remember her getting there. I remember feeling the dread. Of watching her walk out the compound, and that guy still stuck behind the glass being like, oh God, he's going to suffocate in there.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what I had in my mind as the ending of the film.
We are brothers from another mother.
I wonder if that's the, so here's the thing with this film, like for years since I watched this, I have said that this film would have been my dream film debut. My first short film was called Perfect, and it was very much in line with Ex Machina in terms of theme, and the tone that I was trying to achieve. Like if I'd have had a budget, that's what I would have wanted Perfect to look like, you know?
Okay.
I will say that watching it this second time around, and it is only the second time I've watched it, which is so surprising to me because, like I say, I've been bigging this up as, oh, it's like perfect science fiction, in my opinion. I didn't enjoy it quite as much as I did the first time. I compare it a little bit to A House of Cards, where, like, you know, you see it and you're like, wow, that's incredible. But actually, under the surface, there's a little bit of ricketiness. Now, again, that's not to say that I didn't enjoy this, because I did. I loved it. I thought it was brilliant. But I kind of, when you were telling me that you were having a bit of a struggle to kind of get through this, I totally got where you were coming from. I was like, wow, this is a lot slower than I remember it. And it doesn't quite... Like, it took a little bit more than... I think I was wowed the first time I saw it.
I would agree. Like, I think, obviously, there's some of them that do... Like, all the Ari Aster stuff is good with a second view. To be fair...
Right, rewatchable, right?
To be fair, this is good with a second view quickly after the first. Like, because I did watch almost half of it the first time and then rewatch it. Because it's not a long film. It's only... You know, hail to the short film, by the way. Not the actual short film, but the short feature film, because I just think that's always the best way to go.
But yeah, it's just over 100
with this
minutes.
One, like, when I watched it a second time, knowing kind of who she was and knowing also, like, the connections that exist in that house that they don't tell you about.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. Then things made a lot more sense. Like, things that I didn't twig on the first time that I just felt were kind of weird or placed in the wrong area, they weren't. It was just like, oh, this is, I'm supposed to notice this because it's the second time I've seen it through, but you wouldn't see this on the first. So, but yeah, I also had that as we were describing, that kind of initial disappointment. So story, though, we'll get you there. Second thing I would say with this one to remember is the VFX. We're going to talk about that because the way they did the VFX was really cool. And I guess if I was going to give onto a third thing, I would say cast. I have a confession to make that I wanted to make on the podcast so everyone could laugh at me. Because it's it was really, really fucking embarrassing. So Oscar Isaacs, right? Mm-hmm. Let's talk about him for a minute, because Ed has been banging on to me about Oscar Isaacs for ages. Not just since, you know, not just since Star Wars, but whatever. And he keeps saying, you should love this guy. Ed's very good at picking out people that have similar ethnic backgrounds to Ed and I and saying, like, you'd like this guy. So he's a French Guatemalan. I'm a French Ecuadorian. So, I mean, I'm not actually from France or Ecuador. He's actually from Guatemala. So, sorry, he has kind of one up on me.
He grew up like in Denver or something like that.
So, you know, other than him being an immigrant, me not being an immigrant, like, you know what I mean? Like, that's about the same. So I always kind of like this guy, but I confused him for somebody else because I knew nothing about Oscar Isaacs as the person.
Okay.
I confused him with, if you've ever seen the movie, guys, 10 Things I Hate About You, there is a guy on that. And I looked up his name 2 days ago. Now I don't have it. It's like Dershowitz or something like that. It is not Oscar Isaacs. But I was for sure that's the same guy. So, like, when I was doing all this production stuff, I was looking it up and then I found out it wasn't the same guy. And I just felt like, you know, you can't, like, send apology cards to people you don't know, but I just wanted to send one to Oscar and be like, I have basically been watching your career for a couple years now and totally thought you were somebody else.
That's funny.
Sorry, Oscar. Like, if I could send you a card big enough, I would. Because the reason that's important to me is...
He is brilliant, though, isn't he?
He's brilliant. He's a brilliant actor. He came out of nowhere. That's what I love even more about this guy. You know, he started Ex Machina as one of his first films. You know what I mean? It's one of the first things he works on. And his presence as, you know, he's supposed to be this cross between Jack Dorsey and maybe a little bit of Mark Zuckerberg. But he's playing that, basically what I would call the Silicon Valley twat. You know what I mean? Like, the one who's been, he's uber smart, but he doesn't realize he's uber smart because he's been uber privileged most of his life. That's something those guys never seem to pick up on. Like, it's easy to be that smart when you've not had to struggle much. Anyways, not getting too much into that because we love Twitter.
He is quite interesting. The interesting thing is he has been around for kind of a while, but you're right, Ex Machina was kind of the first time that appeared
stage. And I guess what I'm saying is I thought this guy was a child actor because the dude from 10 Things I Hate About You was a child actor, okay? He was in a bunch of stuff when he was little. This guy was never a child actor. He started his acting career pretty soon, you know, pretty soon before this. Let me see.
Well, actually, he's been around since like the early 2000s. The first time that I really kind of noticed him was inside Llewyn Davis, where he played the lead.
That's his first feature, as far as I know. And that was in 2013.
No. I mean, he was in The Bourne Legacy as well. He was in Robin Hood with what's his name?
Yes, he plays King Crow. John, right?
Yeah. And he was in Chair as well, which I love those films. But, you know, like, smaller parts, nothing really big. But Llewyn Davis really kind of, you know, of course, it's the Coen brothers. Like, you know, you're gonna get noticed if you get cast in as the lead in a Coen brothers movie.
No, definitely. Yeah, no, and you'll remember him from that role. I mean, that was the year before Ex Machina. And, man, that film, if you haven't seen it, the thing that got me when I saw that Inside Llewyn Davis is I didn't think it was from 2013. I thought it was more like 2016. So is it really surprised me that the movie was that old? I'm talking about, you know, Greenwich Village, man. That's my mom's old hangout, man. Don't even get me started.
Yeah.
story she could tell you about hippie, what that was like in the 60s, you know?
Hippie
well,
bill,
I loved,
right?
I loved my mom's comment. We were talking about the Electric Circus because it came up in a show I was watching, Mad Men, and they go to the Electric Circus. And my mom used to go to the Electric Circus. She'd sneak out of her house in Long Island. She lived, you know, down in Elmont, and come up to the Electric Circus. And my mom was like, you know, they only served coffee there. And I was like, like, I didn't want to say anything to her because she's a nice old lady. And I'd be like, yeah, sure, Ma. I said, yeah, no, you guys weren't drinking beer for sure, but pretty sure there's a lot of other things going on at your circus. You know, she saw some great bands, though. Sly and the Family Stone. It's one of my mom's claims to fame. Right. She was like, she reached out and touched the guy. It was awesome.
Have you ever seen the film Drive?
I have and I haven't. Like, it's one of those films I'll turn it on and be like, everyone tells me this is great. Ryan Gosling's a decent actor, so I'll go with it. I always fell asleep, like, pretty much after the intro.
Okay, so you won't have noticed that Oscar Isaac kind of plays the bad guy in that, and he's really good.
No. I don't even know the plot. Don't remember him from Che. That's why I'm saying all that those bit parts beforehand. I wouldn't have recognized. I guess I would have seen his face and still thought he was this other guy. So that's probably why I'm going to go back and watch these things again and be like, okay, so not the dude from 10 Things
Drive,
I Hate About You.
Drive is definitely worth checking out. I remember watching that and being really impressed by him, but not knowing who he was, you know? It wasn't like when Llewyn Davis came out, I was like, wow, this guy's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I just, and as I said, apologies again, Mr. Isaacs, like, you are a very strong actor. Ed's even pointing out you've had an even longer career that I need to stop thinking you're another actor. And I will go back. Che is, you know, mutually between Ed and I, one of our favorite, even both films. Part two, part one was so much better.
It drags a little. I'm not
going to
lie.
Part two just gets a bit muddled because that's how Che's life was at that time. You know what I mean? But part one, it was definitely like when they open and then you see like that first part of Cuba just turning red. I was like, yes, yes, the revolution.
So how did you feel about Domhnall Gleeson in this one?
I loved him in this one. And that's because it's another actor who I've seen in things, but I didn't know he's... Domhnall Gleeson is really versatile, okay? So I saw him in Goodbye, Christopher Robin, which is, you know, the last couple years, I love Winnie the Pooh. I grew up on Winnie the Pooh. It's my thing,
like, super,
you know,
sad,
talk
right?
to Ed, like, and this is all about what the actual Winnie the Pooh was. Like, and I never knew. Like, I had no idea how A.E. Milne made those films or made those books. Mm. And this goes into kind of the rise and the fall of the series and what was wrong with it at the end. Because obviously he used his own child, you know, for that. He plays A.A. Milne. So, I mean, and he does it. Like, I would have just assumed he was English. You know what I mean? Like, I wouldn't have known any different. Yeah. It could have been Benedict Cumberbatch for all I know. You know what I mean? It was like, just a good Englishman. You know what I mean? A good, good that type of Englishman. So, saw him in that. Then what was the other thing that he was listed for that I recognized? And I'm just going to go here and see if I can find it.
He was in... He was in Never Let Me Go. He did Harry Potter as well.
That was it. He has a brief appearance in Harry Potter as the older Weasley. And I like
that. Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, you know, obviously he's the son of a famous actor. So
Brendan Gleeson.
Yeah. I haven't had too many rants on the podcast about that. Now, obviously in my life, I hung out with a few celebrities in my time. I won't say who, but, you know, a lot of them were like child actors of parents or whatever. So I have kind of an axe to grind against that because some of them just weren't very talented. And it was like, I got this great new role. And you'd be like, yeah, it's because your dad. Like, whatever.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, it happens. And trust me, I got plenty of jobs and promotions and things in my life because of who my parents were as well. So, you know, it's not that I'm knocking that. It's the first thing I say about child actors. So I'm always like, or I'm always like, yeah, is he as good
second
as
second generation? Right.
I can't make that argument here. He's equally the actor his father is. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and his father's a legend.
A legendary actor.
He really, I think he was so vital to this film as well, because he is the person that we connect with, right? The awkward, you know, like, young guy.
Well, I wanted to talk to you about that. Because I disagree.
Oh, okay.
And I don't know whether it was just me. This is why I was asking you, because, you know, I'm really narcissistic. So we're going to put this on the podcast. Anybody else can answer this as well if you want out there in Freedom Land. I identified more with Oscar Isaac's character than I did.
I thought
with
you would.
Him.
Yeah,
I
thought you would. And
especially
it's
after
not,
I just shat on Jack Dorsey and all that, I'm like, yeah, no. But when I watched the film, I was Oscar Isaac's character, not.
It's not really. I mean, again, I think that you have the everyman, right? Which I think is Domhnall Gleeson, but I think you also have the, like, alpha, like, you know, genius guy who we all want to be, you know?
Yeah, and I think it was, for me, it was like, because Oscar, it's the overarching personality, right? So Oscar Isaac as an inventor, and this might be, you know, exposing some horrible character flaws, so I apologize. You know, he does some really horrible things in the film, but he always sees the potential problem with these machines. He always sees kind of the overarching issue that if you let them free, he says it in the film, he foreshadows his own death by saying, you know, I am the person that invented the end of the human race, where, you know, when machines look back at this back in the day, they'll laugh at how they had such, you know, fallible creators. Yeah.
Right.
And I'm also a kind of person, just, you know, the scene that I love the most is when he's talking about, like, you called me God, and he's like, I didn't say that.
Yeah, yeah.
That happens between Ed and I all the time. And God, my wife
suddenly
and I
things,
remembered
very differently.
It's like, no, I said it that way. And she's like, that's not what
I
said.
I totally understand what you're saying, though. Like, I think that it is this, and I think it's another reflection of Alex Garland and his great writing. The fact that you have these very two different, diametrically opposed, seemingly at least, characters, but actually they have a lot more in common than you think.
That's correct.
However,
no, go ahead.
Sorry, go on.
No, you go.
No,
you go.
Okay. So I will say, as much as I love both of these actors and both of these characters are spectacular. I mean, for me, Alicia Vikander steals the show. I don't know how you feel about that.
I think she plays it because I went back and read the production notes on how all of this was set up. So I think she followed the instructions she was given really, really well. I think she is a really good actress. Mm-hmm. However, it didn't steal the show for me.
Okay, interesting.
What I will say is they definitely, from what I was told, Alex Garland was big on making sure that she wasn't too robotic. So when I watched the behind the scenes stuff on this, the whole point was, they said the whole thing was, again, this is kind of emanating some of the Ari Aster stuff. They wanted this to be a discussion between two people, not a guy discussing something with a robot. They wanted it to be the opposite of that. The VFX kind of felt melded into that as well. But so she was told not to be so wooden. And then she found kind of a balance between the two, where she was slightly more wooden than, you know, a human being would be, but also had ticks like a human would, because that would be part of her development as this AI. So, no, don't get me wrong. Like, I think she did a wonderful performance in it. It just, like, you know, if I had to rank him, it would be Oscar, Donald, and then Alicia. But close.
Okay, that's
close,
fair.
Close in all three. You know what I mean? Close
all three. Yeah, I think you're right in you know, just pointing out that the cast is a huge reason why this film works. And shout out to Sonoya Mizuno as well. I thought she was fantastic as well.
That's right.
The kind of Japanese. you think she's a servant at first. She turns out to be something else. It's very cool.
Yeah. And I guess that was the other reason I kept trying to say Oscar Isaacs was undeveloped. Like, these were new actors that now everybody can, you know, General Hux, you know, these are people that are now, God knows if we could ever afford them, Ed, you know what I mean? But
right. Yeah, they weren't superstars. Now they're superstars.
And I guess my point was Ex Machina grabs all three of them before they really hit their stride. And this helps them hit their stride, but it is not the film that breaks them out. Like, it's you know, Inside Llewellyn Davis was the one for Oscar Isaacs, but it was quick. And so what I mean by that is, again, we're talking top of the end indie film, right? You now reached your, I want to establish myself as someone firmly who's going to be able to do film after film after film. The actors are what keep this one, you know, from slipping below anything less than grand. Yeah. Like,
because this could have been terrible, I think.
Absolutely terrible.
I think if it wasn't pitch perfect, I think it could have been terrible.
This story without the right cast, without the right dynamic between people, wouldn't have worked. You need...
And again, the cinematography, again, man, which I know we're going to talk about, but... Whew! Wow. Rob Hardy really impressed me.
Well, and let's get into that then, because I think we've talked, you know, cast at least, we've kind of set our graces on it, and, you know, we don't spend too much time on everything, but, you know, that was the final point I made, is get a good cast, they've done it here. If you want to see how they did it, there are extensive notes online as to how they recruited each of these guys onto the thing. It's what you need to start thinking about. It's what I have to do. And it's probably the hardest part of my job because I don't really know any actors in London. I know people that are starting out here, but I don't know any names. And so it's like, you know, it's one of those things that your production goes up in value. Hereditary was the last one we talked about like that. The minute they got, you know, Muriel's Wedding, please, Ed, I'm horrible with names. Please.
Toni Collette.
There we go. Toni Collette. You know, this film already had a budget that could go higher because you had Toni Collette. Yeah. When you don't have that, which is often the situation I'm in, you're just pleading. You know, you're like, you know, we'll get somebody, we'll find somebody. I'm sure somebody will want to do this. But until you have those locked in actors, they're a big part of the game. And the longer I'm in this, you know, doing what I do as a producer, the more I kind of understand how important they are to the success of a film. So they had three here that you could point to and say, these are decent actors on the rise. You know what I mean? Mm. You've seen Inside Llewellyn Davis. You've seen Harry Potter. You've seen... you know, all these different things. Watch this film. It's got all three of them in one of their best performances.
Absolutely.
So,
absolutely.
Closing that off, sorry, moving on to cinematography, Ed. Tell us about the sexy cameras.
Well, Rob Hardy is the cinematographer on this one. And I'll be honest, I'd not really heard much about him. I wasn't really familiar with his name. He's not one of the first cinematographers that I think of, but boy, did he do a good job on this. I think they both had, both him and Alex Garland had a very good kind of vision for the film. Mm. So, you know, you mentioned about the lenses. He used some Cook lenses. Cook is a manufacturer of lenses that has been in the UK for a very, very long time. They make amazing glass. But these had been rehoused lenses. What that means is that the glass was originally made in 1922, but they were put into modern housing, basically like the skin of the lens.
Oh, wow.
In the 80s. So basically what you get is when you get something that's not mass produced, that's handmade, it has flaws. It has a color tint to it, right? And all of these elements give a lens character.
So cool.
It is cool. I own a Soviet lens.
That's the one you showed me. Oh, I remember this now. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. So this is a Soviet lens. It was originally made for a Super 16 camera. And because of the cameras that I like to use, it matches very well. The frame size and the like. Mm. And this lens is beautiful. It's a bit of a pain because, again, it's an old housing, so the focus and the aperture rings are very close together. If you kind of, you know, do it wrong, you'll change the focus when you were trying to change the aperture. Okay. Or vice versa. It also just like comes apart. If you can unscrew it and just keep unscrewing it and keep on, and it just like you end up with two parts.
And this is what happens with Jason. Like, how much did this cost us again? Uh-oh. Do we have insurance? So the only thing I will say from my perspective too, and this goes out to Sash as well. When you guys show me your awesome lenses, you guys are like Gollum. You know, it's like, it's my precious. It's my precious.
Yeah. Glass, man. Glass. Indie filmmakers out there. Worry less about the camera you're using and more about the lenses.
Absolutely.
That you're using.
And that's, I think that I somehow knew that's the point you were going to get to, because that's definitely, you know, on the budget, the camera, and they talked about the cameras because there was a, whether they were going to use an Arri Red on this one, they ended up going with a
Sony F65.
Yeah. I mean, they debated between a couple, and the Arri Red would have been just fine for it as well. But
I think it might have been a bit too early for those. I mean, not really.
No, it wasn't the red. It was like, the Aries something else. I can't remember what they were saying. But there was a debate between that and another.
Yeah. But it was the first film that Rob Hardy shot digitally, which I was super impressed with.
Oh,
because
really?
He used... Yeah. He was used to doing film, everything on film. And he turned around and did a really great job, because that transition is not as easy as you might imagine, going from film to digital or digital to film. It's a very different workflow, even though a lot of the words are the same and, you know, we need to load the camera and we need to do this and we need to, you know.
Yeah, but it's like, you know, from my perspective, I know it from a musician standpoint between analog and digital. And even though the concepts are similar for both, like the actual mechanics are incredibly different. And that's the difference you're talking about here. So, I mean, I'm getting to the point now, and it's only because I'm getting delusions of grandeur, but... Someday I would like to make like a film, like a 35mm.
Oh, fuck yeah.
It costs a fortune, but it's because the way that the exposure to light and things work with that is different. It can be imitated in a digital camera, but a digital camera's natural state isn't the same. A digital camera is actually trying to operate more like our eye, you know, and it's probably got all those. But, you know, film is film. It only has certain things you can do with it. I am, you know, Ed would be happy to hear this, so I will say this on the podcast. I have gotten around not being able to get through the story of film. I now watch it with my breakfast and lunch breaks and have gotten very far. And if you want, Ed gave this to me for my birthday last year and said, mate, like this is you're a deep diver. This will teach you everything.
I knew if you got into it, you would
get into
it.
He's like, if you want to know everything there is to know about film from the get go, this guy literally just walks you through how shots were created. And this is what he does. He literally goes to the Lumiere brothers. I mean, I'm literally only 45 minutes in, because you'll stop and go back just to hear about another change that they made. And the first time they came up with shot and counter shots, and the first time they did a close up, which was with this little cat.
A montage.
Yeah, the first
thing,
did you know that the first time a close up was done was with the little cat drinking milk? I mean, how cool is that, right? Like, this is what I'm talking about. But it teaches you also about color, hue, and what was experimental at that time, which had a lot to do with playing with the light source and playing with shadows in the background and seeing what you could do.
Yes.
You know, it's still used today. You know what I mean? And that's what I find
amazing.
Well,
I mean, talking about, you know, this film and Rob Hardy, he uses almost exclusively tungsten lights. He does not use daylight lights, which probably means nothing to most people listening to this, but it's like the difference between a light bulb, like the old school, you know, filament light bulbs, and like an LED today. Like you can look up at a light fixture and be like, that's an LED, or that's an old school bulb with a filament.
Yeah.
And it's really, really interesting. He's very, very talented. But they also did this thing where they lit for 360 degree filming, which is super rare.
Okay.
Right. Rather than building a kind of half set like you would on a TV show, right? You think of the Friends apartments,
if you walk around the back of it, obviously there's nothing there,
right? These guys built sets at Pinewood Studios and lit them in 360 degrees for the actors, so that the actors could then go in there and do whatever felt right without any limitations of, oh, if you take a step here, you're not on the set anymore, right? It was like if they were shooting in an actual... Yeah.
And that's an important thing to bring up, because it's something I didn't mention at the get-go, but that when we're talking about the filming of this, the production on this is unique, and I would encourage you to read that. So the other reason this is not your average indie film is the $10 million budget is a misnomer. It should have been made for, I would put this up there, maybe Baby Driver levels with $20, $30 million, possibly more, $40, $50. The reason it was done so shot, they did 15... Count that, 15 to 25 setups a day.
Jesus.
15 to 25 setups a day. Like, Ed, when we shoot, we don't do 50. Like, we're just being honest. I cannot do at this point in my career 15 to 25 setups in a day.
We also have like 5 people on set.
Well,
do you know what I mean?
Even with 50, like, though, like, I'm not quite sure I could do 25 setups in a day.
But see, this is why, right? Because they lit the sets at 360 degrees, it meant that there was no wasted time in setting up lights for the next shot.
That's right. So, right? And getting into that, because that was part of what I was saying that for, because this was done over a 6-week shoot. That's the other reason it comes in at 10 million. And let me tell you, and it's not just me that would tell you this, and it's not like I have a whole lot of experience with this type of shoot, but Katie Bonham and I used to back and forth on doing quick shoots like this, because on a budget, like when I write down the numbers for you and say, this is how much can it cost, if you can take something that was supposed to be 10 weeks and condense it into 6 for me, Jesus Christ, yeah, we've saved a ton of money.
So much money,
that could be a third of the budget just gone off of that. Yeah, so Alex Garland, you know, stepped up to the plate on this one. And I'm just so impressed with him and his crew, you know, and the producers on this one, because they were determined to do a high quality sci-fi film on a really cheap budget. And the reason I brought up Baby Driver is Baby Driver was a high quality action film done on a really cheap budget the same way for 20-30 million, because what it's your favorite guy, Edgar Wright, did on that one was literally just his editing process is so quick because he knows his shots. And so he was able to wrap everything up faster than a normal. So another way you can, you know, claim to fame as an indie producer or an indie filmmaker is learning to shortcut those days. Now, that doesn't mean that you go out there and you work your crew 18 hours a day with no plan. Like,
right. Or that you cut corners like some people do.
Exactly. To do a 6-week shoot like this, what you have to do is pre-produce the hell out of everything. That's probably why the 360 lighting worked, because when they walked into that studio, they knew they were going to do that and then said, we're just going to have it all set up. The point that Ed was making, and it's made in the notes of talking about the actors, is that when they did shoots, they just did what felt right. They didn't have to worry about having the angles right. It was like, go in there, have a normal conversation. We'll be filming you at the same time, and let it go as long as it needs to, and then we'll move on to the next setup.
It's very freeing for the actors, I think. And again, when your gaffer doesn't have to break down the lights and move them and then bring up new lights in the new location and check them and have the stand-ins, that all eats time, right? So it's very smart. It's almost to the point where, why don't more people do that? And I think that it probably is quite scary when you're building a set and you make it to be lit it from any angle that you shoot from. But I think that expenditure is worth it in the long run because of what you save.
Yes. Right? So I would say the other cool thing about this is not only do they have 15 to 25 setups, 6-week shoot, but they're having to do 2 sets of shots for everything. So for everything that she was in. So they do, and I like this method because it's cheap. It's not, you know, it's not one of those things that's going to cost you a lot of money to do, but instead of, you know, green screening the hell out of everything, there was, you know, according to them, there were no green screens on this particular setup, but they would do a clean pass every time. So when they would do, in other words, you'd have the actors come in and do their bit, and then they took the camera back in and they would have to remember the movement of what they did before, but they would do that again. And so then they would have two perfect films matched up with each other. And then we're getting the VFX part here. Then they rotoscoped. And so that's where I think this is brilliant, because there are a million more expensive techniques you can use, and rotoscoping is painful. However, it really probably cut down on costs here because it made a simple solution for them.
Do you want to just explain what rotoscoping is?
I'd rather that you did, Eddie.
Oh, sure. Okay. So essentially, it's kind of what cartoon artists do in terms of having layers. The best way to explain it is if you are able to, there are 24 frames in 1 second, right? And if you are able to cut something out for each of those 24 frames, then you can remove it from a shot. In the old days, we talked about it being like a very old technique. It was, they would paint onto the film, right? They'd paint onto the reels for color, also for special effects. You know, there'd be like you know, someone would take a journey down into the sea and Neptune would show up and he'd do something, and the way they would do it would literally by taking that frame, that single frame, painting it, and then the next one painting it, and then the next one painting it. And that is rotoscoping essentially. It's a very painstaking time-consuming technique for adding things, removing things, but it works because, again, film is 24 frames per second.
Yeah, I mean,
for the most part.
Shout out to you animators out there. Why you couldn't just be settled with comic books instead, I don't know, because, like, man, like, I love them both, you know what I mean? And anyone listening, by the way, I'm desperate to, like, hang out, start doing productions with animation people. I'm reading a ton of comic books right now. But my whole point is, like, the process for putting that together, you know, we think we have to do things as live action producers and filmmakers, and it's like animation, like, that's where you earn your stripes, mate. You know what I mean? Like,
that's hard work.
Hard work. And it comes out great. Yeah. Like, I, you know, very few animations I would say I don't like, but wow, just a different work ethic.
It's interesting as well that some of the early cartoons, and the reason why they seem a little bit like stuttery is because they tended to do 10 frames or 12 frames per second. Mm. Because it was much cheaper for them to do half the amount of drawings, right?
That's right.
So that's kind of interesting. But yeah, the VFX in this, and boy, did they stand up beautifully. I mean,
that's right. So, I mean, the comments I would make talking about the VFX, because we are getting close to the end of the show here, so it is kind of hitting on all the different points. Again, production's done so well, so quick. You know, this is, you know, Alex Garland himself would say this is normally a 6-7 month shoot. He did it 6-7 weeks instead, or 6 weeks instead. But with VFX, like, they managed to keep the money down via the rotoscope, but they didn't skimp on the details. So, again, stuff to look up online if you're interested in delving into this further and you find this fascinating, because I did, and that's why I did all this research. Like, they were very concerned with what the body looked like, you know, otherwise. They didn't want you to just kind of see machine in person. It had to be a living thing. And so the amount of detail that's actually put into that, the rest of the parts that you can't see, the parts that are hers are the gray mesh suit. She wore that for the entirety of it. That was her acting bit. That's what she wore.
Yeah.
So those parts of her are her. And then obviously all those clear parts, those are the rotoscope. That is the VFX. But they took a ton of time figuring out each of those little bits. And even though we might not appreciate, you know, all the little things that were done, they did. Now, what is my point with all that? Well, you're going to say, Jason, I didn't notice the fluctuating thing in the thing, and I didn't notice this, and I didn't notice that. Let me tell you why that doesn't matter. It's a con, right? The whole art of filmmaking, and Ed's Story of Film talks a lot about this, about it's not necessarily always making things the most realistic. It's about making them easiest to trick the audience, you know, into believing it's real. Now, if you have a set where you are not being taken out of the reality of the situation because you've got some audacious suit she's wearing that doesn't look real to you, or if the dialogue is stilted because it just doesn't seem quite right to you, all these itty-bitty factors, the same things we were talking about when we talked about why Ari Aster is such a great attention to detail, you're not doing it really so anyone looks at it. You're doing it precisely for the opposite reason. You're doing it so no one looks at it. So when the action happens, the people are focused, because films are psychology, my friend, not actual, like, not visual art. That's the best thing I learned about the story of film. And I totally agree with that statement. Like, we are not watching these things to see what's happening. We almost already know what's going to happen on the screen because it imitates things from our own existence, our own lives.
Right.
What we're really grabbing onto is the psychology. And if you have bad visuals, or in the indie world, at least the horror indie world, bad sound is where this comes in.
It will take
you completely out of the film. So you want your sound to be perfect. And apologies, because mine isn't always perfect on this show or on my other stuff. And I get really frustrated about that. But you want your sound to be perfect. And equally, visuals, you want them to be something. It doesn't honestly matter what you put there, as long as it's not something that takes the person out of the movie. And in Ex Machina, the reason people love this film and it did so well is because everything in that film is designed not to take you out of the action, to put you in that compound with them in that moment. And there were a million other ways they could have done the opposite and completely take you out, because sci-fi does that. It's the big fear we all have with Dune. Dune doesn't work. It didn't work with the David Lynch version because you just couldn't grab onto it. You know what I mean? It was like, it doesn't feel like the book, but it also doesn't feel anything like real life. It doesn't even feel like these actors. It just was a bit of a mess. And so, you know, don't get me wrong, it's a good film, but it's not what people wanted for this. I've seen the stills, and obviously they got my man Deacons on it, so, you know, I'm hopeful. I'm really hopeful because yeah, man. They're supposed to have it, you know.
Denis Villeneuve is the guy that I would give it to.
He does understand attitude, so the whole thing with Dune will be about portraying those characters as real people. Like, people like, so apparently Paul Moadib is going to be a very sulky kind of, like, you know, character that way. That may, you know, knock at the purists who are like, well, he's not like that in the book. But the whole point is, if he can make a connection to a modern audience with that, and people look at Paul Moadib and think he represents the youth of now, you've got a hit on your hands. And that's the producer. That's where Jason puts on the producer hat and tells you that. Because don't get me wrong, the Dune series, I've read almost all of them, guys, and Jesus, there's a lot of them. And I love those books. But a book is, you know, no one has read the, you know, no one has really bought the 7th or 8th one except the diehard fans. And this movie, no one will go see, you know, if it's not entertaining. If you want to make it entertaining, you've got to grab that audience. And I just think Ex Machina really shows how to do that. Not just in the story, not just in the casting choices, but in their ability to, you know, kind of walk through a real life scenario of that happening. In other words, you feel like this could really be happening.
Absolutely. And I mean, they won an Oscar for visual effects. So clearly they were doing something right.
Yeah, I think, I mean, over 800 shots in this RVFX. So, you know, good on you guys, because, man, that's a lot of shots. That's an awful lot of VFX shots. But, you know, as I said, take a look online at some of this stuff. I really like the commentary they talked about. The android was not meant to look like C-3PO or any other kind of alien. They wanted it to look natural. And I think that comes across even better when they're like, she's going to get dressed up and go into, you know, whatever. The only thing I would caution, that with all of this realism, I think the only thing they semi-shot themselves in the foot with was the payoff for the end. And what I mean by that is they make her too likable. And it's the same problem you have in Let the Right One In. You remember how I told you Let Me In and Let the Right One In? The difference is in Let Me In, they're honest about the fact that this girl's a killer and that she's not a nice person. You know, this is an android, guys. Like, she doesn't honestly care about Donald Gleason's character.
Yeah. You know, I kind of wanted, and I think it's totally your fault, by the way, but I kind of wanted it to be a bit more extreme at the end. Like, I wanted a bit more horror. I wanted a little bit more, fear from Alicia Vikander. Like, that she caused me fear, you know? But you're right, because otherwise you just feel like, oh, good on you, girl.
No, and
get out there.
And don't get me wrong. Like, I think I get. I'm not in Alex's head. And Alex, if you ever want to have a coffee and talk about your stuff, you're one of the most prolific writers. I've read all your stuff. So, dude, hit me up.
I love him.
Brunch. We'll do brunch at Bill's. Brunch at Bill's. That's what we do. But, like, I think that pulled into what Alex was trying to do. The reason it is scary is because it's not scary. When she walks up with that knife, she doesn't run. She doesn't. She doesn't do any big movement.
I did like that.
She did it all with a smile on her face, almost like in a Stepford Wife place. And that's why she's so dangerous, because the minute she gets out into the outside world, like, people won't have a clue as to the fact that she is this horribly dangerous, you know, AI that is, you know, figuring out ways to, you know, further herself in the world. You know, it's just, again, that's why I always was with the Oscar Isaacs character. I'm like, yeah, you've got to kind of incinerate these ones once they're done. Now, I wouldn't have done what he did. He turns the old ones into sex slaves. I don't think that's very nice.
Yeah.
But, you know, like, I'm not saying I related to that, guys. It's not cool. Don't turn your old robots into sex slaves.
Do you know what, though? It had a different resonance with me watching it this time, you know, after kind of everything that's happened with Me Too and everything like that, because that hit harder this time around.
The abuse of the android women, yeah.
Yeah. It was easier to not associate, but to feel sorry for
it. It's Ava. It's a wonderful piece of irony he put in there, and please don't crucify me for this comment, but, you know, he's a man that treats women as objects because of his mind, right? Because he's that smart. And at least that seems to be built into that story that, you know, he treats these women not as human beings. Ironically, they aren't human beings. And so he's allowed to treat them that way. So, you know, that's the thing. It's like, where is he doing anything wrong because they're not human? And that's the whole point of any discussion you have about AI and robots. It's always about, can we kill them because they're not really human? And it's, I don't think there's an answer to that. I'm just saying that kind of spirals that debate and is why the story is just so good on this one.
And I think, yeah, absolutely. That element of it still feeling fresh and just the way it's approached, I think it's very smart. Very, very smart. Great piece of writing, great piece of directing, great acting, great cinematography. I think that's why I loved it so much the first time around. This time around, I feel like I can see the flaws. They're a little bit more apparent to me. But I still would love it if our big break was something like this.
Yeah, no, and that's, I guess, why I kept, to end our little show here. Oh, it's always so sad when we come to the end, but, this is what Ed and I are aiming for. We want to get, like I said before, we're not hoping to make this our first film. God knows I've made my first film, and we've made our kind of a couple short films, but the whole point is getting up to the speed where we want to be, and this is kind of like I would see as not a swan song, but the end for us, the end game of what we wanted, that we would get
of what we started out
of
with.
Love Victoria Productions, what we're aiming to do. The idea, and as of now, we have a couple development ideas for stuff like this, but nothing in hard script. But A, we think we could accomplish something like this. B, we love playing around with the VFX side of things. We're obsessed right now with, the HTC V, the Unreal Engine, and what things can be done, on the cheap with some really cool tech. It's our jam. It's the ideas. We want to take something that should be $50 million and make it for 10 and then be praised for it. You know what I mean? Because again, this film only grosses 20. So the other point to make from a production standpoint is Alex Garland was also smart enough to realize that this film was never going to make $50 million. So you need to make a budget appropriate for that. Ari Aster the same way. There's something to be said about independent studios that can understand that like, a horror film isn't necessarily going to make $150 million at the box office. So you cannot.
It's not a home run.
Exactly.
It's
you can't have a budget of $75 million because you're never going to recoup that money. As I said, it was the worst example of that. And this was a big budget film, but everybody remembers Cats and and I still don't like ribbon on the guy, except that I'm a producer. And I'm like, how could you not do the basic stuff on that? You know what I mean? Like, you had $100 million to play with.
Yeah, maybe one day we'll do one. The one that I kind of compare. Did you ever watch Transcendence?
Sounds familiar. What's it about?
It's a Johnny Depp vehicle, and it's directed by Wally Pfister, who is famous for being Chris Nolan's DP.
Okay,
like the guy who did Dark Knight and all those great films. Sure. I mean, He's phenomenal, but it is a very, very flawed film, and it's a sci-fi film, and I think it does all the things that we talked about where we said, this is how it could have gone
this
wrong.
This is the one you were talking about. He mentions this film to me every once in a while and says, have you seen it yet? And I haven't. And he talked about it saying, it's one you should watch because I think you'd appreciate it. And I love Johnny Depp. So, I've always been a big Johnny Depp fan. So
I think you would appreciate it, but I think it would be a very interesting discussion to talk about where they went wrong in comparison to, where they went right with this.
And I think Ed brings up a good final point. Listen, we give you a lot of positives and we tell you, do this, watch this film and do this. And I think Ed's right. We may go back and look at some films that weren't done properly to show you, at least in our view. And again, this is no criticism of the production team because we believe every film has a lot of love behind it and has a lot of work behind it. So before you go out there and shit on film, and it really does piss me off when people do this on Facebook, somebody was having a debate today on the Fright Fest one about who's better, Ty West or Ari Aster. Neither is better than the other guys. Like, they're both very talented directors with very good crews behind them. Please stop thinking it has to be one or the other. Even the shittest film you've ever seen had a bunch of people that were working for their money. You know what I mean? Like
Ed Wood, man. That's the famous guy, right? Ed Wood, Man of Space.
So, it's just my pet peeve now because I it's one of those things. You get mad about different things.
But honestly, Ari Aster, for me.
Yeah, personal no, choice. Okay, yeah, that's not fair. But yeah, I was thinking the same thing. Like, I just, okay, so a little Easter egg at the end here before we sign off. Like, yeah, I did love that debate because Ed knows just how much I don't like Ty West. And that's not because Ty's about.
I actually like him a lot. But
he definitely hit, the whole point is like, and this is something I had to learn as a producer, like, sometimes it doesn't matter if I like it or not. Other people loved his work.
Exactly.
And don't get me wrong, House of the Devil is probably my favorite of his, but you know, my wife and I, we watched The Innkeepers and we just weren't, I would say, millennial enough. Like, we were like, nothing happens in this film and all they do is talk. Mm. And then there's like one scary scene at the end and it was like, we waited for this? And I'm sure, I'm absolutely sure people watched Hereditary and Midsommar being like, I waited all this time for this. Yeah. So, you know, to each his own, to each his own. So,
it's interesting.
But yeah, Ari Aster all the way. Sorry, Ty. So do a film with you, Ty. Let me know, buddy. Love you, Ty. Okay, so we're going to sign off here. Thank you so much for your time today, guys. We've had a blast talking about Ex Machina, finally. Like I said, I think maybe next time Ed and I are going to maybe pick a bad film and talk about that and talk about where things didn't quite work. You know, critical
art. Have you seen his follow-up? It's not Hereditary. That's Ari Aster.
Skyfall? But, that's what he was on before this?
Annihilation.
No, I haven't watched Annihilation, the Natalie Portman. I should, because I absolutely love Natalie Portman. Like, I think she's one of the, not like love her like that, but I just, as an actress, I think she's so
good. Yeah, she's wonderful. So maybe
we'll have a look at that. We'll have a think, and we'll come back to you
guys. We'll have a talk.
So thank you very much for listening, though. Remember to check us out on all the social media that we talked about, www.lovevictoriaproductions.com for the, you know, the website with the most. And finally, on the podcast, please subscribe, share, and like, and comment. As I said, tell us anything you want. We like to talk about our films and like to talk about just about anything when it comes to film or otherwise. So thanks again for listening, though. We will catch you next week. And peace.
Thank you.